Kleinhaus.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Emil Kleinhaus from Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen, and Katz. I represent the Education Management Appellants. Your Honors, Section 316B of the Trust Indenture Act serves an important but limited function. As this Court stated in Bank of New York versus First Millennium, albeit in dicta, the statute prohibits majority bondholders from collusively agreeing to modify a bond's payment terms. The decision on appeal, which concluded that the statute goes further and protects each noteholder's practical ability to collect in the context of a restructuring, is flawed for three reasons. It's at odds with the language of the statute, it's at odds with the statute's legislative history, and it adopts a construction of the statute that lacks a limiting principle and would supplant well-established creditor remedies.
The language of the statute is a little ambiguous. So when you say it's at odds, what language?
I do think it's at odds with the language, because what the statute protects is the right to receive payment. Now, in a context of an indenture contract, the right to receive payment, the entitlement to payment, is necessarily defined by the indenture itself. This Court in First Millennium also said that nothing in the Trust Indenture Act prevents parties from putting conditions on the right to payment. Now, in this case, there were two critical conditions. One is the indenture explicitly recognized that secured lenders could foreclose on the issuer's assets, and two is the indenture explicitly recognized that guarantees could be released by secured creditors. Now, the reason the noteholders agreed to those conditions is that they were paid to do so. They got a 20% total yield approximately. That 20% total yield accounted for the risk of lending behind $1.3 billion of secured debt and the risk that creditors could exercise their remedies.
So, Kleinhaus, before we get into these important questions, doctrinal questions and statutory questions, I need your help before we get into the proverbial weeds of statutory interpretation. It would be helpful to me, at least, if you could walk us through the restructuring transaction itself, just the facts, so that you can describe, if you would, the context in which we're discussing all of this. So among the questions I'd be interested in knowing is, who proposed the restructuring? Who proposed the terms of the restructuring? What alternatives did Marblegate offer to the restructuring? And of course, any other details that you think of a factual nature, we would need to understand the legal dispute at issue here.
Sure. So this restructuring was heavily negotiated. There's some issue in the briefing as to whether it was adversarial, but in fact, there was extensive negotiation between the company, the secured lenders, and a lot of noteholders as to what should happen here. And the company did what I think the company should do, which is that they pushed back very hard to try to get a deal that would work for all of its creditors. And after extensive back and forth, what was agreed was that there'd be a restructuring whereby the debt holders would become the new equity and both secured and unsecured creditors would reduce their claims substantially, consensually. The goal was to get everybody on board, but if anyone didn't come on board, the secured lenders were understandably unwilling, as in any foreclosure context, to let their collateral, which they bargained for, be taken by creditors that didn't bargain for that collateral. So the parties agreed that in the absence of a consensus, what would happen is that the secured lenders would exercise exactly the two contractual rights I mentioned. They would foreclose, and they would also release a guarantee. Now, at that point, Marblegate and anyone else who didn't participate in the restructuring would retain their right to receive payment in the sense that they would receive all rights under state law that belong to creditors. And those rights under state law are substantial. And fraudulent transfer law, for example, which has been around for 500 years and which is codified in every single state, that body of law sets forth very particular and well-established rules as to when the practical ability to recover should be protected and when it shouldn't. But what the district court's decision here does is, first of all, it unwinds that. In terms of the remainder of the restructuring, the parties made that agreement. Marblegate brought a preliminary injunction motion to try to enjoin the restructuring. The district court denied the preliminary injunction, but agreed on the merits, essentially. What happened then is the restructuring closed in part as to all the creditors that agreed, and the company was contractually required to seek to continue and complete the restructuring by releasing the guarantee as permitted by the indenture, and that's why we're here today.
And Marblegate represents what, 2%? What percentage of the total?
It's about face $14 million out of $217 million of unsecured debt.
And so, and your description of the facts here indicates, if I'm not mistaken, that they didn't, their non-participation in the arrangement did not injure them in any way. Is that your position?
Well, yes, in the sense that they bargained for what happened. In the context of an indenture where the entitlement is defined by the indenture itself, where there are conditions in the indenture contract on the right to payment, as this court in First Millennium said there could be, as the UPIC court in the Southern District said there could be, particularly as regards secured debt, Marblegate was not injured in the sense that they got what they bargained for. And
essentially your position that irrespective of how we read 316B, the affected holders here agreed via the indenture to two particular conditions which gave you the absolute untrammeled right to do what you did, irrespective of how we read right or impaired or affected.
That's correct. Now, the Trust Indenture Act is still highly important in the sense that it prevents an agreement to allow a majority to reduce the claim. That's what the Trust Indenture Act does, and I get there not only...
But I'm trying to understand. I'm viewing this from what I heard you say, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that whether or not the terms were rewritten, amended, which you say did not occur here, and irrespective of whether the holder's right to get something was affected or impaired, all of that is irrelevant because they agreed via the indenture to two conditions which you pursued, and that ends the discussion.
That's not precisely my position.
Oh, okay, then you add to it now.
My position, Your Honor, is that these kinds of agreements, these particular agreements, these conditions on the right are completely consistent with the Trust Indenture Act. Now, had they agreed that a majority could reduce their claim from 100 to 50, or say the claim for payment is due?
Well, all right, but help me. I'm not as sophisticated as you in these corporate and litigating transactions. But you are not resting on their having agreed to two particular conditions. You are now saying that we do have to view this transaction in light of the wording of the statute, and if we don't find that satisfying, the legislative history surrounding it.
Your Honor, those conditions are what we are resting on, and my point, Your Honor, is that those conditions are consistent with the language, because a right in a context of an indenture, as the UPIC case says, as the First Millennium case says, a right is defined by the indenture itself. There are only certain things that Section 316B prohibits, and what Section 316B prohibits is majority action to reduce the claim.
All right, then let's go directly to that. In this case, all the assets were transferred away, and the parent guarantee was done away with. Simply put, that which the holders thought they could get was simply annihilated. There was nothing that they could further pursue. At least that's my understanding. Now, against that background, you say that the statute, which attempts in some way to make the right, that is to say, because it's not defined, something that they're entitled to, whatever that might be, is not impaired or affected. Statute says nothing about having to be rewritten or formally amended. It simply says if this right to something is impaired, once again, not defined, but as I understand it in layman's terms, impaired simply means diminished. Furthermore, you say it's not affected. That is to say, no effect resulted from that. Explain all that to me.
All right, Your Honor, I'm out of time. May I answer the question?
Go ahead.
Your Honor, the language, I believe, is consistent with the position that in the context of an indenture contract, you need a change. And here's why. A right is an entitlement. an entitlement in the context of an indenture is defined by the indenture itself. Now, the reason why you need a majority action to change the entitlement, not just an action that could affect the ability to recover, is both comes from the word right, but it's also from the structure in legislative history. Section 316 as a whole, 316B is in the middle. Section 316A says, here's what a majority can do under the indenture. A majority...
316A are exceptions. So what are you telling us? B is an exception to the exception?
316A, Your Honor.
316A says you may do certain things, but B says this is it.
316A, as I understand it and as I read it, says that every single indenture will have a term that says that a majority can take certain actions, including waiving defaults.
I thought it said may. Am I wrong? That word is not in 316?
The indenture, to be qualified, shall automatically be deemed to contain provisions authorizing the holders of not less than a majority in principal amount, et cetera, to direct the time method, or B, on behalf of the holders to consent. So A says a majority can do certain things. That's in every indenture. B is the exception to A.
The answer to your question, to Judge Straub's question, is the word may doesn't appear there. It says shall.
I think A1, which is the provision on majorities, does not have may. 2 says that as to postponement of interest, which is a particular type of majority provision, the statute may contain provisions allowing 75%.
It may contain certain provisions.
As to postponement of interest. But as
he
to
doesn't say may or may not. It simply says certain things shall not be done. So how is that an exception to the prior section, which is full of exceptions?
I think it's an exception to A1, which is the general rule that most things under an indenture can be done by a majority. And it's not just me saying this. Here's what Chairman Douglas said about the predecessor to 316B. He said the effect of the exception is merely to prohibit provisions, again, provisions authorizing a majority to force a non-assenting security holder to accept a reduction or postponement of his claim. In other words, and I'm still quoting, this provision merely restricts the power of the majority to change those particular phases of the contract. So I think when you look at 316A1, 316B, Chairman Douglas's testimony, and the key word in the statute, which is right, which in an indenture context is defined by the document itself, the contract, that's under the UPIC case, under this court's First Millennium case, you put that all together, by far the best reading of the statute is that requires an action by a majority to change the terms of the contract.
Let me go back to Professor William O. Douglas, who was then chairman of the SEC, and let me quote this language on this point. He described Section 316B as designed, and I quote, to place a check or control over the majority, forcing on the minorities a debt readjustment plan. Isn't that exactly what took place here?
No. In two ways it wasn't. One is it wasn't by majority action of note holders. It was as a result of pre-existing state law rights and contractual rights of secured creditors. And second of all, it was not a debt readjustment.
It was contemplated by the indenture.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Contemplated by the indenture.
The indenture contemplated that secured lenders, and this just recognized the rights secured lenders have under state law, could foreclose and they could release guarantees. And there also wasn't a debt readjustment, as Chairman Douglas said. I mean, Chairman Douglas, in the language that I read, made very clear what he meant by debt readjustment. He was talking about changing the particular phases of the contract that deal with the amount owed and the due dates.
Let's go back a moment while you're up to the question that you addressed initially about that the district court's approach lacks a limiting principle. Maybe you could sort of explain what you mean by that, and I'll have a question for you on that.
Sure. So the district court's decision says that everybody recognizes that the statute can't protect against any action that has a practical effect on recoveries, that would be impossibly broad. So the district court, recognizing that, imported a principle into Section 316B saying this practical ability to get repaid is only protected in the context of restructurings. Now, that's nowhere in the statute. First of all, but second of all, it's not administratable. What's happened since the district court's decision came down is there's been a slew of lawsuits against major American corporations challenging all manner of standard restructuring transactions that are permitted by indentures. There are five, six more major lawsuits based on this provision. And that doesn't account for all the transactions that haven't happened, because lawyers can't give opinions now that basic restructuring transactions are not restructurings that would fall within this exception.
Let me suggest one limiting principle, which was offered, I think, by the amicus Caesars Entertainment Corporation, namely that Section 316B forbids only transactions that amount to a comprehensive restructuring of all the issuer's debt. That sounds like a limiting principle, no?
Yeah, but, Your Honor, it's untethered from the statute. There's nowhere in the statute that can be found, and there's no distinction also in the statute between comprehensive and non-comprehensive. So that limiting principle is even further removed from the statute in the sense that it's just taking the inability to find a limiting principle and imposing another non-statutory portion to that limiting principle. So I don't think there's any statutory basis for that.
Let me go to another question, another matter to which you referred glancingly just now, the proverbial bond market. You argue that if we affirm the district court's judgment, we will disrupt the bond market, right?
Correct.
To tell us in what way that, how exactly would that be the case?
Well, the bond market depends on predictability, and the Sharon Steel decision from this court is very informative on that. And what happened here is that particular actions by secured lenders that are laid out clearly in the documents that everybody thought they could do, based on a judicial after-the-fact review, using a limiting principle that's not in the statute, the judge looked at the transaction and concluded that even though the indenture contemplated the transactions at issue, and even though the right to payment in terms of the entitlement to bring a claim and the amount owed wasn't changed, the transaction violated the Trust Indenture Act. So there's great uncertainty caused by this decision.
And that's already been caused, in your view?
I think so. I mean, there's a commentator, which I'll mention. His name is Ben Logan, who wrote a long article about this decision in the March 2016 bankruptcy law letter, which I recommend, which says that out-of-court restructurings have ground to a halt as a result of this decision.
Is that cited in your brief?
It's not, because it came in after the briefs.
All right. Why don't you send it to us,
sure,
copies to opposing counsel,
sure,
for whatever comment they may wish to make by letter, and that can be done. What's today, Thursday, by next Monday at noon in the usual course. Let me ask you, Judge Baer, the late Judge Baer's decision in Mitchella, were the bond markets disrupted at that time?
I guess a few comments on McCullough. One is, I mean, it was an unpublished decision. The only decisions that cited it over 15 years were to disagree with and distinguish it. So it didn't have a lot of effect doctrinally. You look at the Annotated Trust Indenture Act, which is a long document going through the case of the Trust Indenture Act. It doesn't even mention the McCullough decision. But what we've seen after this decision is a slew of lawsuits challenging all kinds of out-of-court transactions, because if the Trust Indenture Act is read to do more than protect against majority amendment of court terms, it opens up all kinds of standard transactions to challenge.
Isn't the impact of a holding which you advocate for here the simple fact that unless there is a formal amendment, an actual rewriting pursuant to B, anything goes?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And that's because what Section 316B of the Trust Indenture Act plainly does protect is the amount owed and the due date. So you need a bankruptcy to change that, because only in bankruptcy can a majority amend those terms and you get a discharge from the court. So outside of bankruptcy, you do transactions, you're subject to litigation risk and all kinds of state law rights.
Such as this, where there are $0 left to pursue.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, there's $0 left to pursue because when the transaction started, the value of the company was way below the secured debt, and the unsecured creditors stood to recover nothing absent a consensual transaction. So the zero at the end is from the starting point of zero. So this was a company that did not have any assets to pay its unsecured creditors, and there was $1.3 billion of secured debt, which comes back to a 20% all-in yield, because this was an assumed risk that secured creditors would take action because most of the debt was secured and they bargained for these creditor remedies.
And this, I mean, yeah, there are amounts, but then there's a right to sue for that, whatever the amount is.
Correct.
That's fundamentally your point.
Yeah, the right to sue.
That right was not impaired. It may come to nothing, but the right itself to pursue a claim.
Absolutely, and the right to pursue all creditor remedies under state law. And state law here is immense. I mean, there's centuries of case law.
A mess or immense?
Oh, I meant to say immense. Please, I hope the transcript on that is clear. immense. There's codified statutes in all 50 states, centuries of case law. This is a widely covered area of the law.
I want to assure the other side, by the way, that
they'll be
given. I'm not tilting in terms of time in any respect. But before you sit down, since the bankruptcy code has been mentioned, most companies would, for those of us like Judge Straub and me, who have agrarian backgrounds, and unaccustomed to dealing with such matters, most companies would be able to take advantage of the bankruptcy code, right? So, I mean, why does this? I'm sure there's an obvious answer to this. Why does educational management not take advantage of the bankruptcy code?
Title IV of federal law, they wouldn't be able to continue to get federal funding.
And this is all about the federal funding, right? And making sure that EDMC retain its Title IV funding.
Yeah, as to education management, yes, but in answer to Judge Gamarra's question, I would also say that there are lots of reasons lots of companies don't want to file for bankruptcy, which is why there are exchange offers and out-of-court transactions all the time, which are now being challenged under the TIA.
So this case is, in some respects, sui generis, as Judge Loyer suggests, because of the effect on funding by the Department of Education.
Only in that very narrow respect is it sui generis. As all these lawsuits show, as the Caesars case shows, as the market.
The record was that the fundamental reason that this form of debt restructuring was pursued was to avoid the loss of Title IV funding.
In this particular case, correct, yes. Okay.
All right, let's hear from Ms. Apps in behalf of the steering committee.
Good morning, Your Honor. Antonia Apps. May it please the Court, I am appearing for the steering committee for the Ad Hoc Committee of Term Loan Lenders. The company owed the secured lenders $1.3 billion when it became unable to pay its debts in 2014, and it was undisputed in the district court that the company's value fell significantly short of that amount by some $250 million. And because the secured lenders had liens on substantially all of the company's assets, all of the company's value belonged to the secured lenders in the event of a foreclosure or liquidation. The unsecured lenders, such as Marblegate, stood to receive nothing. Now, to answer Judge Straub's question about the conditions that the ultimate foreclosure was proceeding on, and Judge Cabranes asked about the transaction, there was effectively a plan A and a plan B in the structure of the restructuring transaction. Plan A was to try and get unanimity, consent from all of the bondholders. Ultimately, 98% of all of the debt holders consented to the transaction, but Marblegate representing
and that 10, meant converting their notes into equity.
Correct. The plan A, the plan A was to convert all of their debt into equity, but that required 100% of consent from all bondholders. Plan B, failing 100% consent, which is what happened here because Marblegate essentially was a holdout.
No guarantee.
Correct. Plan B was for the secured lenders to exercise, to Judge Straub's questions, existing rights under state foreclosure law and under contractual law, which is to release a guarantee. And under the indenture, the Marblegate and all bondholders were fully apprised. It was in full disclosure explained to them that any guarantee they had on their notes could be released automatically should secured senior lenders release their guarantees. And that is why the offering circular for the bonds disclosed up front that the note holders, the unsecured note holders such as Marblegate, should assign no value to the guarantee. So in other words, the transaction had a plan A and a plan B. What happened was plan B, because there was not 100% consent, 100% of consent. And plan B was simply exercising secured lenders' senior priority rights under the Uniform Commercial Code, state foreclosure rights that have existed.
Your position is this is what they agreed to.
This is certainly what Marblegate agreed to, because they knew that the secured debt had priority rights over them in a foreclosure or sale. And in fact, if you look at...
You don't even have to get to the details of the section.
Well, the way the district court interpreted Section 3...
I'm asking you, don't get me back to the district court. Answer my question. Are those two that you just now described, your Plan A and Plan B, is it sufficient to hold that this was authorized, there were no restrictions on it, and therefore we need not define what a right is or impairment or affected means?
Your Honor, the only slight disagreement I have with the breadth of what you have just said is...
Well, I understood you to make it that broad.
The secured lenders are exercising those rights, which are independent of anything that happened in the indenture, although there was full disclosure about that. If the court were to, it doesn't mean the court can avoid, if you like, interpreting Section 3116B, because if the court were to interpret Section 3116B in as broad a manner that Marblegate proposes, it would sweep away pre-existing foreclosure rights it effectively would work as a preemption on the state foreclosure rights and contract rights that the secured lenders...
Untrammeled rights. They must be viewed in light of 316B.
We would submit, Your Honor, 316...
Yes or
yes.
No?
The court must interpret 316... Yes, the court must interpret 316B in such a way as to allow the creditors to exercise their pre-existing secured rights under foreclosure law and contractual law.
You cannot have an indenture that has all sorts of obligations and impairs the right of some note holders, the minority note holders, to do X, Y, or Z because of 316B.
Correct. So 316B.
So you can't have an indenture. You can't the argument can never be, well, the indenture permitted the majority note holders to do X, Y, or Z.
Right.
It's got to be seen within the framework of 316, the prohibitions of 316B, but those are very limited prohibitions.
Right, correct. The prohibition, you can't ignore the Section 316B because it has a bar on the sort of provisions that can be included or not included in the indenture.
Right.
But to be clear, there was no, the secured lenders were not exercising rights under the indenture. They were exercising rights they already had in other documents unrelated to the indenture. And what's critical about Section 316B,
what are those other documents?
They're all in the record. They had a credit agreement which gave them priority, gave them liens over substantially all of the assets, which existed well before these notes came into existence. Critically though, of course, there was Marblegate knew that because there was disclosure of that.
Judge Lohier answered my question, despite the fact I can't get a clear one from all of you folks, that no matter what A and B were, or anything that may be in these other documents that you now refer to, all of them must still be viewed through the prism of 316B. Isn't that correct?
Your Honor, I disagree with the formulation of the question. I don't think it's the prism of 316B. I think 316B puts a limitation.
316B, does it apply even though A and B are there and these other documents provide other certain rights?
316B prohibits certain provisions by in
I understand
indenture.
That it does.
Right.
Let's not argue about what it does or doesn't do. Do you agree that 316B must be applied to plans A and B and whatever other rights exist in these other documents?
Your Honor, we don't think that we proceeded under the indenture in Plan B. We exercised independent rights. If you interpret the TIA Section 316B so broadly as to prevent public companies from reorganizing their debt in a way that at any time, is
but
a practical
But in order to so interpret it, we must use the language of 316B. Isn't that correct?
Correct. We must. But if you look at the language.
Now you're into the argument as to why, in applying 316B, we should interpret it as you suggest, as opposed to how your friend does.
Correct.
All right.
But to be clear, what is really critical here is that 316B is tied to majority bondholder action. To come back to Judge Straub, your two conditions, the actions here were not done by a bondholder majority. So regardless of the district court's decision, there can be no infringement of the 316B here.
In what sense was it not done by a majority?
Because we were on Plan B and the secured lenders were exercising foreclosure rights, they did not require any amendment or change to any terms of the indenture.
It didn't require, in principle, any majority of any kind.
Correct. And the district court recognized that 316B, as First Millennium has held, as UPIC has held, that 316B is only triggered when there is majority bondholder action. And there was no such action.
Your colleague was very careful to describe dicta in those decisions. It's not a holding, it's dicta.
First Millennium is dicta, UPIC is a holding, Your Honor, and UPIC, of course, held that that 316B cannot override an indenture's subordination provisions, and this indenture explicitly told the bondholders that they were effectively junior to the secured lenders.
And perhaps I can ask arguably a relevant question. I'm asking you to describe the position of opposing counsel or the other side. How do you interpret their purpose and goal here? Is it merely by being a holdout, you get certain advantages, as we know from real estate and other matters?
By being a holdout here, they have essentially, the district court has given them 100 cents on the dollar when senior lenders with senior priority were required to compromise their claims at a significant discount. When you give bondholders, an unsecured bondholders, effectively a holdout remedy that entitles them to 100%, not only do you turn the capital structure on its head, but you effectively put a stop on, perhaps stop is too strong a word, but you are significantly reducing the likelihood of all out-of-court restructurings, not just ones limited to companies that need Title IV funding.
Bondholders are going to say, well, you know what? Let's do what Marblegate did.
Absolutely. And notwithstanding this, one might say that this case involved an educational institution with Title IV funding. But to be clear, the district court's decision, as written, applies to all out-of-court restructurings. And there is no practical way.
What's wrong with Congress with these problems?
Beg your pardon? Well, the thing is that, you know, this TIA statute enacted in 1939, there's never been a need to go to Congress before today, Your Honor.
How do you explain the fact that after so many years of experience with the securities laws and with this one as well, that this large question has never surfaced before?
Because
the Court of Appeals.
Because courts have uniformly, other than the McCullough decision and the recent decisions by below in this court and in Caesars, courts have uniformly interpreted 316B in a very narrow way, consistent with Chairman Douglas's view that this was meant to be a modest provision. It is just something that is
almost formalistic,
but because, as Judge Loya, as you pointed out in questions to my colleague, because there is a huge body of state conveyance law designed to deal with the nuances to come up with when an issuer is really out of the money or really not creditworthy, whether the motivations of the issuer in doing the transactions were somehow improper. And while it might be, I believe it was Judge Cabranes, if I'm mistaken, I apologize, who asked the question about, well, can we just do a limiting principle to out-of-court restructurings where there's a complete reorganization? Believe me, that is not a simple question to answer. As Judge Leo knows, I'm relatively new to the restructuring world, but it is really hard to figure out when an issuer is underwater. There was an expert report down below which was undisputed, showing that in this case it was underwater, but that required enormous expert evidence. In other words, a limiting principle saying, well, this is just unique because it seeks to reorganize all of the assets of the company is not a limiting principle at all. It will require an enormous amount of fact-finding. And, in fact, Judge Shindlin in Caesars said, I can't even figure it out if this is a restructuring. I'm going to let the jury figure it out. And I'm going to say,
at the bottom, she agreed with this district judge, didn't she?
She did, Your Honor. And that is why I think, notwithstanding in the 70 years since the passage of the TIA, because of the formalistic interpretation, there haven't been this slew of courts, as my colleague referred to. There have been since both this decision and the Caesar's decision.
What would an impairment look like under 316B?
If the majority attempted to alter the payment of the principal and interest, if there was a majority amendment that said, we're going to reduce your principal payment, change your interest rate, and there's nothing that the non-assenting bondholders can do about it, that would violate the TIA. I'm hesitant to come back to Judge Straub's question, but that if you read it in that formalistic way,
don't let him scare you.
If you interpret it in that formalistic way, then you never have the problem of the intersection of the state law rights and the credit agreement rights that the secured lenders exercise versus the TIA. Then they're Venn diagrams, circles that never cross. They only cross because.
Perhaps we should have sought amicus brief from Ms. White and Ms. Warren.
You know, the securities regulators no longer really have an active role in the.
But they could.
I think they could.
When you have Chairman Douglas.
Yes.
In legislative history, that means that they could today.
Yeah. I can't comment on whether or not. But just to, I know I'm out of time. I do think it is really. Critical to hit on the fact that, again, there was no majority action here that was taken. The secured lenders' rights exercise state and foreclosure rights and contract law, and it was the plan B of the restructuring was not done through a majority amendment. Therefore, TIA cannot be violated.
And you're arguing for formalism, which there's been much written about formalism in the law and its uses.
But the thing is that the reverse is entirely problematic.
The reverse is postmodernism.
Okay, fair enough.
You're also arguing for realism.
I'm arguing for the bond market to keep going in an untrammeled way. And the problem with a broad interpretation with no limiting principle, with no tie to the statute, is that there's no principle basis to distinguish among transactions that have a practical ability to affect the issue.
You are resting on the views of one of the leading legal realists. The proposition that we should avoid legal realism and postmodernism.
With that, I'll let Your Honor, Judge, you have the last word. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. O'Donnell, go ahead.
May it please the Court, my name is Sean O'Donnell. I'm an attorney with Akin Gumb Strauss Hauer and Feld. With me are my colleagues Pratik Shah and Chris Carty. Together, we represent the appellees in this case, Marblegate Asset Management. Your Honors, the transaction that's at issue in this case was designed to coerce minority note holders to exchange their notes for equity or get nothing. We know that because that's exactly what's stated in plain English in the offering circular. Your Honors, it's at page 8A52 of the record. And if you turn to that, there's a question. It says, why is it important that I tender my notes in the exchange offer? And it goes on to explain. It says, it's important that you tender your notes because if we don't get 100%, and the we, by the way, is not the secured lenders exercising their foreclosure rights. The we is the company. It says, if we don't get 100%, then we are going to, the word is implement, the proposed restructuring through...
I'm sorry, what page is this?
It's at 852 of the record, Your Honor. It's the offering circular.
Yeah.
And if you look toward the middle, you see the question. It says, why is it important that I tender my notes in the exchange offer?
Yes, where in that, in those two paragraphs?
Okay, so answer. In the event that any holder or any lender under our existing credit facilities does not consent to the proposed restructuring, we are required under the terms of the restructuring support agreement. Your Honors, let me pause there for a second. The parties to the restructuring support agreement, Ms. Apps finished a moment ago saying this doesn't involve the majority of note holders. The majority of note holders are parties to that restructuring support agreement that obligates the company to pursue the intercompany sale, as are the secured lenders and is the company. So going back, we are required under the terms of the restructuring support agreement to implement the proposed restructuring over any such objection through the intercompany sale. And then if you go down to the last sentence in that same paragraph, it says what's going to happen as a result of that intercompany sale. It says, as a result, we anticipate that such holders will not receive payment on account of their notes, including then accrued and unpaid interest from and after the date of the proposed restructuring is consummated.
So this is what happened.
This is exactly what happened. And at the beginning of
okay, so you
Mr.
were
Klein,
I'm trying to understand the import of this. So this is what happened, and we are here to figure out whether that was a violation of 316B.
Yes, Your Honor, and it absolutely was a violation of 316B.
Why?
Because it impaired and it affected my client's legal right to payment. Now, we heard a moment ago, there's been a lot of talk, both at oral argument and in the papers, that we're ignoring the word right when it comes to statutory interpretation. My colleagues define right as a legal entitlement. I'll take that definition. But that doesn't end the analysis. You have to go on and read the rest of the statute. And what does the rest of the statute say? It says that you cannot impair.
316B.
Yes, Your Honor. It says that you cannot impair or affect the legal right to be able to sue or the legal right to get your money. Impair, by its plain terms, means to diminish, to weaken, or otherwise affect in an injurious manner. Effect, to prohibit an effect on or to influence in some way. Prior to the proposed restructuring, I have notes. At a minimum, the records establishes that I was going to get paid at least a couple of $1 million in interest on those.
So your contention is you have no right today to receive payment of the principal?
I'm saying my right has been negatively impacted. It's been diminished. It's been weakened. It's been impaired. Because now there are, well actually today, because they
your
did,
payment was, may be impaired, but pardon me. Right. How is that impaired?
And today it's not, because they actually did the restructuring around us, right? So that goes to another point, which is why is it that you haven't seen any of these types of transactions in the courts for so long since Judge Baer's decision in Machala? And the reason why is because this is a black swan. This is the perfect storm. This company, EDMC, relies on Title IV funding. In 2014, it got roughly 78.6% of its revenue from Title IV funding. It's completely understood, both by the company, by Marblegate, as well as the secured lenders, that bankruptcy was not an option and that foreclosure was not an option. There's a memo from its largest creditor, from the secured creditors, that says, the typical water priority, the waterfall priority that we've been hearing so much about, how we come last, isn't relevant here, because that's not the world EDMC lives in. EDMC can't file for bankruptcy, and EDMC and the secured lenders, they can't foreclose without risking triggering the change of control provisions that would have also resulted in the company losing its Title IV funding. We've heard a lot today, and we've seen a lot in the papers, about how this might negatively impact the secured lenders' rights. It's really important to keep in mind, we have not sought to enjoin the secured lenders from doing anything. We made that, Judge Phelan noted that in her decision, and that was discussed at length in oral argument.
Let me make sure I understand something, because this is part of the back and forth with your colleagues on the other side. Are you, is your argument premised in part on the notion that the indenture, the terms of the indenture, 902 and 1006, prevented the majority bondholders from and EDMC from doing what it did?
So 902 and 1006 refer to the release of the guarantees,
right,
Your Honor. It's 607 in the indenture that says, notwithstanding anything else in this contract, you can't impair my rights to receive principal or interest.
Incorporating 316B.
Correct. Right. And I want to be clear.
But so I understand that there is a 316B is an important part of this argument. But if you had just looked at the indenture, are you contending that this was a violation of just the terms of the indenture?
Yes. Okay. 607 says it incorporates the same language that's in Section 3.
Let me say another codicil to my question. If you excluded 607, if you just looked at 902 and 1006, would you still contend that there was a violation of the terms of the indenture excluding 607?
Yes.
Okay, why?
Because this case is not just, they would like to make it very much just about the release of the parent guarantee. And Judge Phelan noted, and I agree, there may be contexts where the simple release of a parent guarantee does not constitute an impairment under 316B. We're not looking to prohibit incidental impairments. But this case is not just about the release of a parent guarantee. This case is about a intercompany sale and a proposed restructuring where a lot of things happened, and it's important to focus on that. So first, there was a payment of the revolvers of several hundred millions of dollars, and then there was another credit that was extended for the revolver. So there's a change in the loan. There's a change in the capital structure of EDMC in order to coerce, to impose the proposed restructuring over the objection of minority note holders by changing, completely refiguring the corporate structure of EDMC such that now we're going to transfer all of our assets from the issuers that issued the notes to a new company. We're going to transfer all of the assets from the subsidiaries that also guaranteed the notes to a new company. And we're going to cancel the parent guarantee. And, by the way, we're going to tell the regulators for months
later. Weren't those steps, at least if not contemplated, then provided for or permitted by 902 and 1006?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because those only spoke to the release of a guarantee. There's a lot more that's going on here. And you can't ignore, or I guess you could, but you shouldn't ignore.
No, I understand the 607.
Right.
Because there's a decision tree here, right? It would be, if this was a clear violation of the terms of the indenture, that would be one thing we could do. And you're telling me that there's actually a dispute about that.
Right. And if you'll pardon me for supposing, but I think that this line of questioning goes a little bit at least toward this notion that there's a bargain for exchange and that we're getting what we bargained for. The opposite's true. So first of all, the notion that Marble Gate's a holdout and that it acquired those notes with that in mind is not at all supported. It's contradicted by the record. Marble Gate began looking at the notes from EDMC back in 2012. It purchased them in January of 2013. That's years prior to May of 2014 when the company announced that it was incurring financial difficulties and that it was going to hire a financial advisor and start negotiations.
It's not a holdout,
with it.
You say.
Correct. But may I go to one more important point?
What did you want, or what do you want now out of this transaction? Presumably, you represent people who want something quite material, quite specific. What is it you want?
We want our bargain for rights, which is to maintain the status quo as it is today. So we another
status quo, which means what exactly?
So the restructuring was done around a small percentage of note holders.
Understood.
And that's where we are today. The notes are continuing to receive interest. One day the principal.
You get $2 million or whatever it is per month.
We get what? I don't think it's $2 million per month.
You want this to continue.
Yes, Your Honor, that's what we bargained for, and it's important also to remember.
Why aren't we were told that you're getting what you bargained for?
Exactly, we are. Well, we are because right now the restructuring has been kept in place. They're saying that somehow that we've bargained for this notion that they can completely restructure the company.
I understand, but what do you want? What's the decretal language that you think we should be adopting? What do you want from this court?
So an affirmance of Judge Fela's decision below, which found that the intercompany sale, as initially drafted, would have been a violation of 316B. And something that's...
And with what effect?
The effect of that is that the guarantees couldn't have been removed, the parent guarantee or the and the new EDMC2 guarantee.
You continue to get paid on the note.
That's right. That's right. And, Your Honor, we've heard...
The
interest payments on the notes are several million dollars we've received so far.
But you're getting, I'm a little slow in these matters, but you are getting these payments. You
yes.
have been getting them, and you will continue to get them.
But the only reason why we're getting the payments and we're continuing to get them is because, we ran in for a preliminary injunction.
Yes.
At the preliminary injunction hearing, my colleagues told the court, there's no way, or it's very unlikely, we certainly can't presume that we're going to be able to restructure this arrangement unless we get 100% consent. And it's really important that we pause there because this problem that we're experiencing and why is it we haven't had this for 20 years, one issue is because it's EDMC is a professional education company and this doesn't come up. The other is because...
The Title IV issue.
Yes, thank you. And the other issue is because they insisted on 100% consent. That's unusual. That's in both of our papers.
Why is that bad?
Because parties recognize and Congress recognize that it's virtually impossible to get 100% consent of note holders. Congress was well aware of the notion that there may be some note holders that hold out.
You are a so-called holdout, and what is it you want for holding out?
I want to keep my notes as is without them impairing or affecting my rights. Now,
But they're not impairing your rights, are they?
They aren't because they didn't proceed with the intercompany sale as they had originally planned. the intercompany sale as originally planned was they would have transferred all of the assets and they would have had a canceled the parent guarantee in place. That was one piece of it. What they've said is, okay, until we find out whether or not the intercompany sale would or would not have been a violation of the Trust Indenture Act, we'll keep the parent guarantee in place. So that's what they've done. And now there's been...
You've got this guarantee in place today.
Correct.
And you have it...
If you were to rule otherwise, if you were to rule that the intercompany sale was completely permissible, notwithstanding the fact that it negatively impaired and affected our rights under the indenture, then we presumably would not.
Your argument is that your right is being impaired.
And we would lose we would lose the guarantee at that point. So there's talk about this slew of cases that are going, the sky is going to fall if you honor.
Feel free to read the note. It's often helpful.
And I said to them, I don't get distracted by notes, sort of, to keep them coming. Right.
We don't hold it against you for not having memorized a response to everything.
No, and I actually think I said this, which is that today we have the old guarantee that remained in place, and they gave us also the new guarantee by EDMC2. That's where all the assets are now by virtue
that's
of
that's how you're really getting paid.
That's what assures that we're going to get paid. But if this court were to find that the intercompany sale were a violation, then that would have been a problem. So another important point to keep in mind here when we talk about this bargain for...
We're in a somewhat odd place because of the district court's decision, your right currently is not being impaired under 316A.
Correct. An affirmance of Judge Fela's decision would presumably result in our notes continuing to be honored. And there's been a lot of talk about this bargain for exchange. First of all, obviously we weren't at the bargaining table when the indenture was issued. But secondly, nothing forced EDMC to issue a qualified note. There's a lot of different ways to raise money, and you can issue notes that aren't qualified by the Trust Indenture Act. There's been a lot of talk about how today the bondholders are sophisticated investors, et cetera. That's fine. If you want to sell to sophisticated investors, use Rule 144. But what you should not be permitted to do is what EDMC is doing now, which is, and by the way, the secured lenders in their credit agreement could have barred the company from issuing qualified notes. They didn't. So what we shouldn't have now is the company, after it reaps the benefits of issuing...
Can you spin out this qualified note avenue?
Sure. So the indenture that was issued is qualified. It's subject to 316B. You can opt out of that. You're not obligated to raise debt that way, even if you wanted to raise debt using notes. You could use a Rule 144A exception, for example, and sell only to sophisticated institutions. That's a narrower body of investors. But if you elect to issue your debt on the qualified notes to a broader range of investors, you shouldn't complain that you have to honor the terms of those qualifications and that you can't impair or...
You are bound by the TIA.
Correct, yes. Exactly. Unless your honors have further questions.
Now, how, if at all, would you limit a holding here affirming the district court?
Judge Straub, I'm so glad you asked that, because if I sat down without providing that answer, I would have been very disappointed in myself. So that's the concern, is that there could be this slippery slope, and that the words affect and impair are quite broad words, and we believe Congress meant for them to be quite broad, but CEO gets sick, that could have a negative impact or negatively impair a noteholder's ability.
Some minor payment.
Correct, and we understand that that's not what the statute was designed to guard against. We suggest the same limiting principle that was followed by Judge Baer and Machala was also applied in Judge Scheinlin, which is whether or not it's directly intended, whether the purpose and effect of the restructuring was to impair the notes. How do we know that's the case here? The intercompany sale only comes into play if they don't get 100% consent. And then, as we saw at page 852 of the record in the company's offering circular, and it's also in the restructuring support agreement, if we don't get 100% consent, then we're going to cram this down. We're going to do
the problem with that limiting principle is that it's nowhere, not even remotely close to seen or found in the language of 316B.
You're right, Your Honor, it's not. But whenever the court interprets a statute, you should read it in context and in light of its legislative purpose. And if you look to the legislative purpose of this act,
We disagree on some of the things that's been read back and forth, but what's indisputable are two important points. First of all, the statute over time, when it was drafted initially in 1936 and then was enacted in 1939, it got broader, not narrower. And it was broadened to encompass not just the right to sue, but also the right to receive. And then the second point, which is really, it's beyond dispute, is that a concern that Congress had and the SEC had when 316B was enacted was that you were gonna have these out-of-court restructurings, you were gonna have majority of note holders who, as here, may have conflicting interests. They may hold both secured debt and they may hold unsecured debt. So what's good for them may not be good for a minority note holder that doesn't own secured debt at the same time or in the same proportion.
Can I ask you a question, Mr. O'Donnell? So if you're right, then why doesn't 316B say something along the following lines, notwithstanding any other provision of the indenture to be qualified, and instead of the right, holder of any indenture security cannot have its payment diminished?
That would be better. But keep in mind that instead what it says is that by using the word impair or affect. That's the meaning of impair and affect, diminish. That's cited in Black's Law Dictionary. It's in our papers.
So is there a difference between impairing or affecting a right as opposed to impairing or affecting an amount of payment on a particular date? So if you have instead of whatever $14.3 million, you think that you can only get $1 million, that affects your payment, but if you can sue for the full amount in state court and federal court and bank wherever,
right?
Does that impair your right?
So it depends on the situation. We could.
Well, once you say it depends on the situation.
Because this case exemplifies that. This case shows that, okay, great. We could have sued post-intercompany sale to collect on the interest of the notes for either principal or interest. But the company tells us what the value is going to be of those notes, right? They tell you in their offering circular, you better convert to equity at a steep discount or you're going to have notes that aren't worth anything at all. You're not going to get paid interest. You're not going to be paid principal. Prior to the intercompany sale, prior to the proposed restructuring, my client held notes. Those notes had value. At a minimum, they had the record shows they would have received several million dollars of interest payments. We believe, and as in fact turned out to be the case, they've gotten more. The notes are still holding their worth, and the reason why is because EDMC doesn't live in a world where bankruptcy was an option, where foreclosure was an option. This wasn't a state foreclosure by the secured lenders. It wasn't a bankruptcy filing by the EDMC. This is something, it was an end run around 316B, where they were gonna try and coerce us to take equity instead of debt over our rights under 316B.
Now, Mr. O'Donnell, you said it depends on the situation. Decisions, therefore, under Section 316B will depend, in your view, on the particular circumstances presented.
I do believe it's case-specific, Your Honor, but I don't think that means, as has been suggested, that there's going to be an army of cases in front of you for several reasons. First of all, the holding by Judge Barron Machala, and also it's stated by Judge Shilin and Caesars and by Judge Fela, if the plan is designed...
The Court of Appeals has ever adopted that view.
The Court of Appeals hasn't spoken yet, Your Honor, so there's actually an opportunity here for you to cabin the application of the statute, and if it were cabined to apply to these facts...
The statute by leaving the door open to particular circumstances.
Well, that's true even if you left it as it is. I mean, it's still a matter of how you're always going to be applying the statute to the facts, and it's likely that there will be case specific, but if you cabined it by saying it's only going to apply to a deliberate attempt when the transaction at issue was designed and has the effect of impairing a note holder's right to receive principal or interest, and that's exactly what it was here. You're not gonna have a waterfall of cases afterwards because First of all, companies can always file for bankruptcy, except some, a company like EDMC, if necessary. And Congress knew that was a likely outcome when it enacted 316B. It knew there were going to be some holdouts. It knew that enacting 316B could result in bankruptcies, but it welcomed that prospect over what they tried to do here, which is have majority decide what's best for the minority.
Well, if I could just follow my earlier question and the earlier colloquy with opposing counsel. You don't think we should adopt a formalistic view of this. You think that you adopt the legal realist view of this. You're more a postmodernist.
You know, I'm not as good with the names, but what I think we should do is.
I don't care how you win.
Pardon me?
I don't care how you win.
Yeah. But what I think we should do is I think we should interpret the statute in light of its purpose. My colleague quoted to the court a moment ago from Chief Douglas, and if you look at the appellate record, it's A2370. That's where the quote came from, and there is a sentence where it says evasion. It says that, in other words, this provision merely restricts the power of the majority to change those particular phases of the contract. But if you read the entire quote, it's very clear. What it refers to, and it begins by referring to a bogey, and it says that there was a concern that all amendments would require unanimous consent, Chief Douglas was addressing that concern by saying it only applies to the issue of principle or interest, and the sentences before and after the one that was quoted to you are quite relevant. It says the effect of this exception is merely to prohibit provisions authorizing such a majority to force a non-assenting security holder to accept a reduction of postponement of his claim for principal, or a reduction of his claim for interest, or postponement thereof for more than 1 year. That's exactly what took place here. That's exactly what the intercompany sale was designed to do. And then there's his quote, where he says it merely restricts the power of the majority to change those particular phases of the contract. But then there's another important sentence that follows, and it says, evasion of judicial scrutiny of the fairness of debt readjustment plans is prevented by this exception. If you were to apply the formalistic approach that you mentioned a moment ago, Your Honor, then you're going to have a slew of cases where they're going to do exactly what EDMC did. We're going to gut the meaning of that statute by circumventing the transaction, label it a foreclosure, allow the notes to stay in place, but transfer everything away such that that legal entitlement to a right to get paid.
It's illusory.
Exactly. Thank you.
Your Honor, I'll be brief because the court has been very generous with its time. First of all, on A52 of the record, a very smart lawyer once told me that the first rule in reading contracts or offering documents or anything is read on. And I'd like to just read on to one sentence here, which says that if the intercompany sale is consummated, holders who not tender their notes in the exchange will continue to have claims against the co-issuers and certain of our subsidiaries that currently guarantee the notes. So I just wanted to point out that that's there in the disclosure. I heard Mr. O'Donnell give several formulations of what the right test here. And the first one he gave, I heard, was the value of a claim is negatively impacted. That should be the test under 316B. That happens every single day when companies operate under public indentures. The company pays a dividend as permitted by the indenture. Of course that affects the value of unsecured notes because the money goes out. The way an indenture works is there are many provisions that define what the company can do that recognize secured lender rights. If those provisions are complied with, if the value of a claim is affected, that's not good enough for 316B. Foreclosure. Mr. O'Donnell, I think I heard him suggest that foreclosure was not recognized in the indenture, unlike the guarantee release. Respectfully, I don't think that's correct. The indenture stated explicitly that there were certain asset sales that were prohibited. So in bargaining for this indenture, the parties agreed asset sales are prohibited, which you can understand why, because if they're asset sales and the company doesn't get sufficient consideration, that can harm note holders. But there was an express exception to that asset sale covenant, which was fully negotiated, the exception being foreclosures. So the indenture deals with foreclosures just as it deals with guarantee releases.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinhaus.
Okay.
Ms. Apps? You reserved a little bit more time.
I did. I have 3 points. First, Judge Straub, you asked about a limiting principle, and I heard Mr. O'Donnell articulate a test of something to the effect of purpose and effect, which I think is slightly different to the limiting principle they proposed in their briefs. What they proposed in their briefs was that TIA only be triggered when there are an exercise of foreclosure rights in a way that's adversarial, all of which is to underscore the fact there is no way to come up with a sensible limiting principle if you adopt an overly broad interpretation of the TIA. So that limiting principle of adversarial foreclosures makes no sense and is completely contrary to state law, because state law foreclosure rights, the Uniform Commercial Code, has a set of very specifically delineated rights, the thrust of which is a secured creditor should maximize the value of the underlying assets to leave the most left over for unsecured creditors and for the debtor. And to adopt a test that says that the TIA is limited, a broad interpretation applies only in adversarial foreclosures, is completely counterintuitive. And again, underscores the fact that there is no workable limiting principle upon an adoption of a broad interpretation of the TIA. Second, Judge Cabranes, you asked about what the bondholders want. Essentially, what they want is 100 cents on the dollar principal and interest payments. That's what the district court gave them. That is essentially the binary option that a broad reading of the TIA gives to holdouts like Marblegate. Now, it is true that in this case, when they actually closed the deal in January following the preliminary injunction hearing, the parties sort of did a Band-Aid, if you like, to leave in place a guarantee to enable Marblegate's notes to have their principal interest to continue to be paid. They did so because the district court ruled that's what they were entitled to. So while in this case they didn't get the preliminary injunction to stop the transaction, there was this Band-Aid adopted, but it was only adopted because of the district judge's decision below. In all future cases, holdouts knowing that they have this extra leverage or strong right under the TIA will not agree and will not consent, essentially.
So right now where we are is that your position must be that, consistent with what Mr. Kleinhaus said in A52, that they can go sue the issuers or subsidiaries and that's it.
They have state law foreclosure rights. Excuse me, I misspoke. They have state law fraudulent conveyance remedies available to them, which is historically the sort of remedies that aggrieved debtors who don't receive payment of their debts exercise. And actually,
fraudulent conveyance rights.
Did I say? I meant to say fraudulent conveyance rights. If I misspoke, I apologize. But the granting the broad interpretation of the TIA is just too strong a medicine, whereas fraudulent conveyance law is well designed to fix that. The third point, just to answer Judge Loyer's question, you asked a series of questions about what provisions under the indenture would be violated absent Section 607, and there was a discussion about two sections, Section 10.06 and Section 9.02. Just to be clear, the secured lenders are relying on Section 10.06, which is an automatic release of the guarantee, not Section 902. The automatic release of the guarantee the bondholders were advised of that, but it is something that the secured lenders exercised under independent contracts under straight contractual law, of which they were well advised. And my last statement, Judge Loyer, on page 844 of the record, they were specifically advised, meaning the company.
The offering circular again?
It is, correct. And it says, if we were unable to repay such indebtedness, the lenders could foreclose on the pledged assets to the exclusion of the holders of the new notes. So none of the actions.
Where is that?
It's 844. It is the second full paragraph. It is in the middle. If we were unable to pay, the lenders could foreclose on the pledged assets to the exclusion of the holders. In other words, the secured lenders exercised state foreclosure rights in a way that did not violate any provision of this indenture, save an extraordinarily broad interpretation of the TIA that would wreak havoc in the bond market.
And what is your view of what it is they're going to be getting moving forward if you prevail?
If
you've heard opposing counsel tell us something on that.
If we prevail, the no further payments will be made on the bonds. They will receive, they have received certain interest payments, payments which we contended they were never entitled to, but as a Band-Aid measure, close the deal, preserving the issue for appeal.
Thank you very much. We'll reserve decision, and we are adjourned.
That was extremely well argued. Thank you.